This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk to New York Times bestselling author Kevin O'Brien, who has a new thriller out. He loves to write these thrillers, and boy, they are compelling, especially this one. It's called Hide Your Fear. I love saying the name of it. I think it comes out July 25th, right, Kevin?
It does. You got it.
July 25th, which is, even though it says August 2017 on the side, it's really July. I love the publishing dates of books. They're never what they're supposed to be.
Yes, yes.
It's like July means August, August means July. Who the hell knows? I mean, you really don't know. I mean, sometimes they have on set dates.
Yeah, and like we were talking about just before we started the show is, you know, they changed the cover on me at the last minute, so you never know what they're going to do to you.
That's right, although we do know October 3rd will be the Dan Brown book. That we know for sure.
Oh, yes.
He's got a really cool cover, too, on his book, which is great.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, I love it. They just released the cover the other day, which, what is it about these publishing companies? Why do they have to hold things back from people?
Oh, you never know. I know, they often don't know the covers until the last minute. It's really weird. I mean, I was with Maria Semple at one of these Seattle 7 parties, and mm-hmm. she was telling me they kept changing her cover on her before her last book came out, and, you know, they had this model, that model, and, you know, the marketing people have to go through many...
Now, you told me they can't change the cover on your book, too. It's not going to be the cover that I'm looking at here.
Right. It's going to be... It looks like a chalet, and it's there's a light on, and it's got a sort of a warm, creepy glow to it.
Well, I must admit, your books do creep me out, but it's in a good way. So.
Oh, good. That's what I like to hear.
And they leave me thinking after I'm done them. I think to myself, God, what a book. And
oh, thank you. Jeez.
And I think about, you know, what these poor characters have been. I said, poor Kevin, he's putting these characters through.
I did. Oh, you get all my angst out on these poor people, you know, any kind of frustration I have. gets released, and I don't know who I was talking to, but they said, you know, some of these romance writers are awfully cranky, but you people who write just serial killer books are so nice, and is it because we get it all out of our system?
You know, look how nice Karen Slaughter is in the book she writes.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, John Saul, he couldn't be a funner, you know, happier person.
Well, this book is 500 and some pages. It's a long book. Now, was it always going to be that long?
You know, the last few books that I've written have been around 500 pages, and I don't intend, I keep telling myself each time I begin a new book, I'm like, keep it down to like 400 pages at the most, and I get carried away. I think I keep coming up with more little twists and turns while I'm actually writing it, and I like to do to tell background stories and stuff like that to build up the characters, and I think all of that just ends up making the book longer. But I'm always so flattered and so relieved when somebody will write in a review, you know, yes, it's 500 pages, but I got it read in two nights because it reads fast. So if it reads fast, I'm hoping at least it reads fast.
It's one of those books you just keep coming back to. You just want to keep coming back to it.
Thank you.
I put it down and then pick it back up again. I said, I've got to get back to that book because it's so intriguing. And I'm like, what's going to happen to this poor family? It's like Poltergeist almost.
You know, the little bit of Poltergeist was in there. My editor gave me this idea. He read something in the New York Daily News about a family that had moved into some house in, you know, upper New York State, and they had someone who was sending them creepy emails, and they knew where the kids' rooms were, they knew everything about the house, and I think they called the guy the Watcher, and they ended up suing, I think, the family that had lived in the house before them, because they knew about it and didn't say anything to the real estate people. people. And so, because they had been getting, stalked by this same person who knew everything about the house. And I don't think they ever caught the guy, but they, he sent me the article, and that's all. All I need to do was look at the first paragraph in the headline. I was like, okay, this is intriguing. Let's not even find out any more about this. Let's just come up with our own story. And so that's how we did it.
I wonder if the guy will read the book. Wouldn't it be weird if he actually read the book?
Oh, my God. I never even thought of that. Oh, wow. That is.
You can autograph for him here.
That's right. Well, speaking of Tom Saul, he was showing me his office, and he said, do you recognize the signature on this fan letter? And I said, no, it's all scratched. And he was like, I'm looking at it, it's from some prison in California. I'm like, oh my God, it was Charles Manson. So he'd written John Saul a fan letter.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention prisons, because I was talking to Joe Finder yesterday, and he says his books are really popular in prisons.
Well, I know that some of our books go to prison, so that's as I was telling you earlier, I'm with the Seattle 7 writers, and we send a lot of our books go to halfway houses and stuff like that. So I know a lot of my books will end up in a prison.
Well, tell me this now. In the United States, your book will be out in mass market, what they call mass market, right?
Right.
Is it that way all over the world?
I think it's in a different size, paper. So it's in like the oversized paper. I forgot what they call it.
Trade paper?
Trade. God, I've been trying to remember what that I have been. It's one of those things that's escaping my 61-year-old mind. I'm like, what is the name? It's not vanity paper. It's trade paper, yes. So it's in trade paper in England and or the UK, I should say, and in Germany. So those are the two other countries.
Can you get it on ebook too?
Sure, everywhere on ebook.
Wonder what they cost on ebook. I'm curious.
Mine, well, right now, I should let me get a little plug in. I think you can get my last three books on ebook for $2.99 each.
Really?
Yeah,
that's a deal.
A summer sale, summer chills, they're calling it. So check out, if you want to get started on my books, that's a nice, cheap way to check it out.
I may sound like an idiot when I say this, but I really like to hold your book when I read it.
I do too. In fact, a friend gave me a Kindle, and I auctioned it off. I ended up telling her, I was like, that was really nice of you, but I'm just a book person, and we ended up raising like $400 for charity by just from people buying tickets to get the for the raffle. So
I just want to give Caitlin a big hug. Poor Caitlin, what she goes through in this book is just like horrific.
Oh, the poor. I know. Long suffering heroines. I always, maybe I sometimes overdo it. I think, oh God. But I do want the reader to kind of sympathize with them and feel for them. And
they're two of the most obedient children I've ever seen in a thriller in my life.
Well, they had she got some problems with her daughter. That's for sure.
But once her daughter understands how angry her mother is, she settles down quite a bit.
Oh, that's true, and that's not true in real life, I think.
No, it makes the daughters angry.
Yeah, it makes the daughters angry.
Suddenly at 16, all the kids know, they all know what they, they know everything.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's earlier now. I have a friend who's got a daughter who's 12 who's driving him crazy, so I think
But when you write these books, I mean, you know they're going to be disturbed. You know that people are going to be disturbed by these books. That doesn't bother you at all.
No.
Or is that the object? And what is the object?
I think it's the roller coaster, syndrome. I think people like to be a little scared and
freaked out
a little bit, and but in a good way. It's a safe way of getting kind of creeped out. At least I feel that way. And I just remember being terrified reading The Exorcist when I was a teenager.
I can't even watch the movie anymore.
Oh yeah. Well, I remember reading the book, and I would have to, after finishing finishing a portion, even though I was dead tired, I'd have to pick up something else to read just to take my mind away from it before trying to fall asleep. So, you know, I think people enjoy that in a weird way. They kind of like the...
And Linda Blair never lived that movie down. Never.
Never did.
It's like the Princess Leia syndrome, you know?
Yeah,
like,
oh yeah. Yeah.
You're always, well, people are always going to remember that movie that you did.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You were that crazy thing that was spinning around
thing.
And,
yes.
And the pea soup was coming out of you. Oh my god.
Well, I think I mentioned The Exorcist and Hide Your Fear.
You seem to like movies because you mentioned movies a lot in your
movie
books.
Big movie fan. Yeah.
When you're not writing or watching movies.
Yes. Yeah, I've got a big movie collection.
Have they ever made movies out of any of your books?
No.
Why?
This is my question. I do have a terrific agent in taking care of my movie deals, and we did have back in 1996 with my second book, Only Son. We did have a movie deal when Tom Hanks was interested in playing the lead, and David Seltzer, who wrote The Omen, was going to direct it. And we actually had a screenplay written by John Pielmeyer, who did Agnes of God, and it was looking like it was getting the green light and everything else, and it just kind of went south, and I think Tom Hanks ended up doing That Thing That You Do instead of this, and so...
But you still got paid.
I still got the money for option money. Yeah, I would have gotten a lot more money once they started photographing the movie, but...
Why do you think it didn't get made?
I think, well, there was a management change at MGM, so I think once Tom Hanks decided he was going to go with another movie, I think they kind of lost interest. It was funny, they kind of went down the food chain for stars. It got to the point where it was like they were finding, you know, some... I don't want to name names because I don't want to be... The stars were getting more and more obscure, and I'm like, he did a movie in the 70s. I remember him, and, you know, and I told my agent, I said, when you get to Cato Kaelin, just give up, forget it, you know? So, it was a little defeating, but I got to keep the money, and it was, I don't have any regrets at all. In fact, I salute, Tom Hanks is one of my heroes, because I think if he hadn't been interested in it, I don't think the movie deal would have become a reality. And in fact, we sold the movie before we sold the book, which I think Grisham did with The Firm, if I'm not mistaken. Once the movie people got interested, then Kensington swiped it up, and then suddenly Reader's Digest was interested in the book, and then everybody... That got the ball rolling. So
good for Tom Hanks.
Yeah,
I should mention your publisher is Kensington or Pinnacle.
Yes,
really, it says Pinnacle on the outside, right?
It's Pinnacle Kensington. Yes, and they
all one of the same company. So yeah. do you have like a competition with Lisa Jackson to see who can have the creepiest books? You are.
Well, she is such a nice woman. She really is. I've gone out to dinner with her.
You'd never know it by reading her books. That's for sure.
I was going to say, but she is a doll. She's a sweet lady, and she is kind of. This is too self-serving, but it's like, if she's Meryl Streep, I might be Glenn Close. Or like, she is the star.
Well, here's the question,
though. I am like the one who's like, I'm like sort of in the background.
No, but you know what you're doing, Kevin. I've read so many, I don't know how many of your books, and every one of them has been enjoyable. I mean, they really have.
Thank you.
I mean, and we wouldn't be talking now if they weren't. I mean, these are worth reading because they're good entertainment. They're good, solid entertainment, especially on like a rainy day. These are perfect to read on a rainy day.
Oh, yeah. I think they're great beach reads. They're great, and it's a weird thing to say, but if I can keep somebody entertained while they're sitting in an airport or on a plane and it makes the time go by fast, that's my dream. I'm like, I'm not looking to change the world. If I can make them conscientious of this or that, or, you know, one thing that's on my mind or something like that, then great. But, you know, it's about entertaining, and it's about...
Now, do they tell you how many books you sell with each book? I mean, do you know that figures, or do they keep it a secret?
It's kind of a mystery to me. There's stuff that you can go on.
Well, then how do you know if you're getting the right... amount of money. I mean, how do you know?
You never know. You never know. I trust my. You just sort of trust your publishing house to give you an accurate.
Now, do you still send it to your agent first before the publishing?
My book, the actual manuscript.
Yeah.
Not anymore. She gets it the same time my editor does. So they.
What is it like for you when you send the book off and you're waiting to hear back? I mean, that must be like torture for you.
You know, it's weird. I've got a great setup with my editor, John Scolimmio. What we usually do, and I think it's unique to most writers, is I come up with an outline that's about 100 pages long, and so he is reading a mini version of the book, and it's got dialogue, description. It is basically a Reader's Digest version of what I'm going to write, and I try and make it entertaining. It doesn't have any 1, 2, 3 ABC. It is all, you know, it was stormy out and blah 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 blah, and you know, just the whole shebang. And so he actually has a really good idea of what the book is about when he gives it the okay, and I get my first check saying, okay, here's your advance.
Well, is Pinnacle that picky about, I mean, once you tell them what it's about, or do they either say, oh yeah, that sounds good, or no, that doesn't,
you know,
start
it,
over?
Like I say, it's this routine is pretty different, I think, from most writers,
right.
So I have a feeling it's different for other, but for me, it's great, because what happens is when I do deliver it to my editor, and he's been waiting, tapping his foot, I'm usually late. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be late this year, I swear. And anyway, by the time I do deliver it, he knows what he's going to get, and he reads it, and he'll come up with maybe his editorial changes will be like literally about 3 points. It's like, oh yeah, the scene where so and so goes into the house, this doesn't make sense to me. Can you just fix this? I have my, as I mentioned, I have my Seattle 7 friends, and they, you know, there's some of them are big shots, and they get these editorial notes from their editor after they've submitted a book that are like 10 pages long, and they've
be frustrating.
Yo, I know some, I won't name names, but I know a couple of big name best-selling authors who have submitted their books and gotten, you know, this wasn't what we've had in mind. You're going to have to rewrite the whole thing. And yeah, so in answer to your question, there is a nervous period just waiting to hear, do they like it? But usually Knockwood, he likes it, and I get the go ahead, and you know, it's like, okay, here are the few things that I need you to change, and let's get it to the copy department.
And how long does it take you to change it?
Not long at all. Once he's, like I say, he knows where the book was going.
So what would happen if you got that 16-page thing back with all the props? What would you do?
You'd see, you'd probably hear the screams all the way from Seattle. You know,
really?
Oh my God, I can't believe I have to do this.
Well, you could just go down to Elizabeth George and then cry.
I will go right to Elizabeth George and ask her to do it. She could probably do it in 2 seconds, I bet. No, it's like, yeah, she's just a block away from me.
But or she'd just give you a big hug and make you feel better. You know?
She'll make me feel better, exactly.
Now everybody out there is saying, oh my God, are they having an affair or something? No, that's not what I mean. Now, don't start the rumors though.
No rumors there.
But, I mean,
she's happily married, her husband's
a hunk. I mean, when you figure, I mean, how much work goes into a writing a book like this? I mean, this is like how many months of work?
There's I get about 9 months between books, basically, and there's a lot of work. And the last few months of writing is, for me, the last, like from September to November when the book is due, it is very concentrated. It's like, it feels like finals week, you know, in college. It's like, all I'm doing is writing, and
there's almost like two separate stories in here. Almost.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things going on. Yeah. There's a lot of things going on in this book. And at first, I was a little confused, and then when it all became clear where it was going after that, I don't want to mention that. When I realized what the story was going to be about, you know, then it became this interesting.
Yeah, it's a little confusing because, like, okay, well, why am I hearing about this teenage boy and who's Aaron and what's his life? Why is his life? And then you're like, well, there's that's weird. There's this going on and that going on, and of course, they have to somehow be related. I think that has been a theme in a lot of my books. I can tell you, we had in Chicago back in the 50s, there was a murder of these three boys, Bobby Peterson, oh, I forgot what their first names were, but it was the Peterson-Schuster murders.
Right.
And it sort of changed the way everybody thought about letting your kids go out to the movies by themselves and stuff, because these boys had done just that, and they never came back. And it was in Chicago, and like 1956, I think, and they eventually found the boys dead, and it was an unsolved murder. And then years later, like in the 70s, Candy Brock from Brock Candy, Brock Candies.
Yeah.
Candy was the heiress of the Brock Candies company, and she disappeared as well and was murdered. And they put it together that somehow these two murders, one from the 70s and one from the 50s, were connected to some stables, and there was something going on at this horse stables that was very nefarious. And it was true. It turned out to be quite true, and I think that always stuck with me as being, I was very fascinated, these two separate stories that somehow come together, and I think that shows up in a lot of my books.
So. Hmm. There's a theme going somewhere.
Yeah, there's a twisted, sick theme, as you can see. But I think growing up in Chicago helped. There were a lot of to set my twisted, sick mind going, because there were a lot of sad, strange, and very scary murders going on from in the 50s and 60s in Chicago.
Do you ever get scared writing your books?
You know, I think it helps. It's very cathartic. It gets it out of my system. I do scare myself sometimes. I think, did I tell you the story about, I don't know if I ever told you this story. I might have told you it in my interview with you before, but I was writing a real creepy scene, and it was like about 3 o'clock in the morning. I write mostly at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of creeped myself out. I got the little, goosebumps and stuff like that writing it. And I realized, I need to get my slang dictionary out of my bedroom. So I get up and walk towards my bedroom, and I look at my door. My front door in my apartment is open. I'm like, what the hell? And I was so creeped out that, I closed the door, grabbed a meat tenderizer out of the kitchen.
Why are we laughing? This is very serious.
I know. I'm walking around checking behind curtains in the closet with a meat tenderizer to make sure, like,
so why was it open?
I have no idea. I think, what happens when I am working on a deadline, I get absent-minded about other stuff. And
you just leave the front door open.
I guess I left the front door
open. Maybe you wanted somebody to come in. Who knows?
I wanted somebody to come in and kill me and put me out of my misery, probably.
Oh, no. Let's not go that far.
I can't finish this damn book when somebody just kill me.
You're putting a lot of weird ideas in your own head, you realize.
And one time I actually realized I'd taken a shower and got out, and the door was not open, but it was unlocked. I was like, oh, my God. If the boy who had seen Psycho at age 13, who's been terrified about taking a shower alone, knew that I would actually take a shower in my apartment with the door unlocked, I never happened. But I think I was so distracted trying to finish the book.
I think I have an alternate title for your book, but I'm not sure I should say it. I might get
something. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you could call this book The Coach.
Yeah. I it's funny. I'm not sure which story ends up more compelling. I think I liked both stories so much, and I think, if this sounds so self-serving, but I think one of my things I aim for is to have the pace,
Well, then I guess people would think it was about football or something.
Yeah. Exactly, but the whole coach idea, I think that was influenced a little bit by, I think it's called Foxcatcher.
Oh, that movie's creepy.
Yeah, creepy. I mean, and I thought of the Steve Carell character in that when I was writing.
You know, that's a very good analogy.
Yeah.
If they make a movie, he's going to play the coach.
Yeah, he would be perfect, wouldn't he? But of course, he'd be playing the same character over again. So, but yeah, I kind of
he'd probably enjoy it, knowing him.
He would, I bet, because he was very memorable in that that movie, and I just used that as sort of a blueprint. I said, you know, if you're going to have this coach, make him.
I wonder what he was like living with for 3 months while he was making that.
Yeah, you do wonder. You do wonder about that. I know.
You go home and you're morose. You're like still the character.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. I know. Well, I have a friend who worked with. I'm having a senior moment. Played Lincoln.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Thank you, Daniel Day-Lewis. And he worked with him when he was in the Gangs of New York. And he signed. He went into a hotel to, you know, while he was making the movie on location, and signed the register under his character's name. And he's so into character that he just, he's kind of.
Well, I mean, it's got to be hard to turn it off and on again.
I bet.
Exactly the same way.
I bet.
I would think you just want to keep filming just so you can keep the rhythm of the character.
Oh, yeah, and I think you'd almost want to do it chronologically, but apparently very rarely do they film the movie chronologically. So.
Well, what the hell goes through your head when you're writing these books? I mean, I'm just wondering what sick thoughts go through your head. Because, I mean, maybe you can't even talk about them. But, I mean, where do you come up with these scenarios? I mean,
you talk about it from
the newspaper, like you get some of the stuff in the newspaper, but is some of it just made up in your head, too?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Which do you get more from a newspaper or your head?
From my head, and sometimes if I'm really stuck, I'll ask a friend, you know, what's one of the creepiest things that happened. I remember once I was working on the book while I was staying with my sister, and I said, you know, when do you think you're the most vulnerable, you know, when you're at home alone? I said, is it when you're down in the basement? And she said, when I'm bringing in the groceries. She said, you know, because I leave the door open. And she said, you know, I sometimes think, you know, somebody can duck in while I have the, you know, bring in the groceries in from the car. And I thought, okay, that's good.
Yeah, I remember when I read a long time ago one of the first Alex Cross books, James Patterson's books, they actually play Twister to decide who to kill next.
Oh, that's funny.
But, I mean, I remember how good that scene was. It just was, that book, well, it worked. It worked on a lot of levels for some reason. It was just, I mean, and I thought to myself, oh my God, this James Patterson's a twisted individual.
Yeah. Well, I think you get particularly twisted when you have to work inside the killer's heads. And I usually don't get into a killer's head
like Thomas Harris. Can you imagine what Thomas Harris goes through?
What Thomas Harris must go through. Yeah, yeah. But I think you do. You have to, at one point, do that. I have a friend who lives across the street who's a psychologist. And
him for dinner, obviously.
for dinner, but not too dinner.
No, for dinner. Okay.
But I will take him out to dinner, and I will grill him. I'll say, you know.
I'm sure you will.
Yeah, here's the. But I'm bummed. I will ask him lots of questions. How's that? I will try and find out what he thinks about, you know, here's the situation in my book. What would you say that the killer's motives here are? How would his thinking be for this? And he's very helpful.
Reading this book, the coach's wife, and I don't want to give too much away, but...
Oh, you can go ahead and give some away.
The coach's wife is a very fascinating character. I'd like to know more. There should be a sequel with her.
Oh, thank you.
She
emerged as a little bit more... from the outline to the actual finished book, she emerged as more of a prominent character because I kind of wanted to focus on her a tiny bit more. For clarification, if somebody is listening about, you know, what we're talking about with the coaches.
I hope somebody's listening.
I hope so. But with the coaches, that some high school students who are swimmers, like swimming champions at different high schools, are suddenly missing. And it's been happening now for about like 2 years. And every once in a while, another one goes missing. And only one or two have turned up, and they've turned up dead. And so Aaron is the most recent high school swimmer.
Aaron's a great character.
I really liked Darren. I had a good time writing his background, and again, I think I like the idea of, you know, they've had a tough life, and here they are toughing it out some more. And he certainly didn't have an easy life. His dad was kind of a ne'er-do-well and like a surfing champion, and his mother was a little bit of a flake, and so he.
Yeah, and I don't quite understand exactly why the coach always wanted him naked.
That's a fascinating question, because I actually went to a high school where we had to swim naked. That's where that came from. And I always felt when I was doing it embarrassed. But it seemed unfair because the girls got swimsuits and the boys didn't. And the girls were separate classes, obviously, and girls weren't allowed in when boys were swimming. But it was a strange setup. And I actually posted something about it on Facebook a couple of years ago and got all these responses from people who said, oh, yeah, they forced me to do this, and no one believes me. No one believes me that we had to go swimming naked in high school. But I think it was a thing that went on for a while. I think the excuse we had when we were having to swim naked was that the fiber of our swimsuits would clog up the drains of the pool, which was, you know, BS, because the girls.
Well, I wonder where it came from.
But you know, I think it was getting boys ready for the military.
But people are going to read this book and think the reason he wanted him naked is because he's attracted to him.
He's a pervert or something,
right?
Like
yeah.
That. Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's apparently had nothing to do with it.
No. I just decided it was tradition. He said, you know, that was his excuse. And I think his other excuse, and I think this is one reason they did it for us in high school too, is it sure kept boys in line. You aren't about to goof off or call a lot of attention to yourself when you're naked, you know, and you're not about to wise off or lip off. So you become very subservient when you're naked. You don't want a lot of attention drawn to yourself.
I bet you can swim faster too when you're naked.
Apparently, you know, this is what I had heard this from different swimmers too. I actually interviewed one of our.
I never thought I'd be talking about naked swimmers.
Swimmers. I actually got in touch with somebody who was a swimming champion at our high school, and we'd been pretty good friends. And I said, you know, could you talk a little about, you know, give me some swimming terms and everything else? And so, because I really wasn't an expert swimmer or anything like that. And so he helped out. In fact, he's right now, he works for Dateline in Hollywood, Dateline NBC.
Really?
And yeah, he's a producer for them. So I was so flattered that he took time out of his busy schedule to. And he's won a couple of Emmys to call me up and talk to me about this.
Yeah.
But he gave me great terms and great, you know, he's like, yeah, no, he would do this type of stroke, and this is how the whistle blows at this time, and blah, 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 and this is how you feel when you're trying to finish a race, and, you know, and so he was great. But he had pointed out, he said, yeah, you feel when you're naked that you're going a little bit faster. You could, you know, you feel a little like nothing's slowing you down at all. So.
Well, people say that, like nudists will say that it makes them feel freer when they're naked a lot.
Yeah, I'm guessing. I don't know.
They have this sense of, you know, I don't care what people think. I'm just going to be naked. And
right.
If I have extra weight on me, who cares? It's me.
At my high school, it was really never an issue. And, you know, there were a lot of fat kids. There were a lot of kids. When I was a freshman, I was, let's just put it that I didn't have any armpit hair. So I was very, very like, oh, God, I don't want to be naked in front of all these people. And, you know, there were a bunch of other kids that were in the same boat as me. So I was like, okay. And, you know, no one was very critical of other people's bodies or anything like that.
So are you writing year round?
All year round. Yeah.
You never stop writing. You never take a break.
I wish, you know, I get jealous of Susan Wiggs. She sometimes will be like, I'm off to Paris. I just finished a book. I'm like, oh, I'll clean out a closet, you know. And that'll be my big event. Okay, yeah, this place is a mess. I need to clean out this closet,
It's funny, I'm asking about that. I asked Joe Finder that same question on Facebook the other day, and he said he takes about 4 days off.
That's about me, too. My big thing is I will get chores done that I've been neglecting for
the freezer and get a big bowl of ice cream or something?
Maybe that should. You know what I do is I will watch an epic. I'll reward myself with an epic and like, okay, yeah, you can kill 3.5 hours. You can watch Gone with the Wind or Exodus or Bridge on the River Kwai or something for, and you just eat popcorn and do nothing all night but just watch this movie. And it's like heaven. It's like getting out of jail because, yeah, it gets a little intense toward the end.
It's funny
because usually my heroines, who are, you know, as the book gets closer and closer, they're working on like no sleep. Like, it's very similar to what I'm going through. They're haggard. They're working on no sleep. They're just kind of at their wits, like just going by their raw nerves and wits.
It reminds me at the very end of Poltergeist where they get that hotel room at the very end.
Yes.
And the next thing you know, you see the TV being
the
thrown
TV
out.
Going
of
out. Yeah. Yep. So, I love that.
She's not going to do that again. That's for sure. Once is enough on that one, you know.
Yep. That's the last time that TV is going to be in the room.
And that's what makes movies so good. You have that little sense of humor that runs through the movie.
I try.
That's why the Golden Girls works so well.
Oh yeah.
You got those heavy dramatic scenes, and then you got something funny right in the middle of it.
And you need that. You need that. You cannot have constant scares and stuff. You need to have a laugh. I think Hitchcock did that a lot.
I remember Sophia says in one of the scenes, she says, the lady needs a kidney to save her life, and she says, you could have one of my kidneys, but you'd be up all night if you took it. But, I mean, they're classic lines, and they bring the heart of the matter to you, but they also make you laugh. And that's so vitally important to that.
Oh, yeah.
The compassion is there, the humor and the drama all mixed.
If you get a good laugh out of your, you know, out of the character or things they do and stuff like that.
Susan Harris was brilliant. When she was writing those episodes, she was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, to be able to create something like that that just outwardly makes you laugh is just so wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's tough to be, you know.
Now, I'm trying to think through Hide Your Fear whether there's anything funny that happens. Yeah, there's a few funny moments.
I think there were a few funny moments laced in there. It wasn't really ha-ha.
There's one at the end where she says to him, I almost didn't recognize you with your clothes on.
Oh.
Or naked. I almost didn't recognize you with your naked.
I got a few chuckles, I think, out of that because it's like, you know, I forgot some of the things he said to the coach, like, you know, really? Are you really going to make me go through this? And you know, so I try and keep the humor in there once in a while. I think
the pool scene near the very end. I won't describe it because I don't want anybody to know what it is. But that was pretty amazing.
Thank you, my editor, because he knows these things. So he said, I saw it coming. I saw it.
Really?
He said,
I didn't see it coming at all.
As soon as you did the setup of the pool and everything else, I said, okay, this is how it's going to wrap up. But he's good. He's good. I remember I was on vacation with him, and he'd fallen asleep watching Witness for the Prosecution.
Oh, yeah.
The old Charles Laughlin and Marlena Dietrich. And he just woke up, like, in the middle of it, and he's like, huh. That looks like Marlena Dietrich is really that same old lady and blah blah. You know, I'm like Jesus. No wonder you get these things. You're brilliant. You're half asleep and you caught this thing right. You knew the ending right away. He just, you know, he'd been, you know, unconscious for half the movie. And
you know what's really, it's really crazy. I'm watching the previews for the new Murder on the Orient Express that's coming out in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually want to see it.
I kind of am interested. I just, you know, it's hard to touch that one, the old one. I mean, with, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
But I don't know. In fact, it's got new people in it, and, you know, it looks like it'd be an interesting movie to watch.
It could be. Then again, it could be.
Even though we know the ending. We know the ending.
Yeah, we know the ending. Yeah.
But still, you know, I don't know. Even we knew the ending of Titanic, too, didn't we?
Yeah.
It sinks.
We did, indeed. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I'll get that in reviews once in a while. That I figured out the ending, but, you know, to me, sometimes you know, if you can solve the mystery, that's one thing. I write mystery thrillers, so if somebody somebody figures out who killed who and why, that's okay with me as long as they keep reading because that they're interested. You know what I mean?
Well, you're the one before this. You'll miss me when I'm gone. I'm hearing that has a really stellar ending.
Thank you.
Now I have to go out and buy it and read it.
Yeah, check it out. Jane, it's on sale.
I don't know. I'd have to go to like a Barnes and Noble to find it, probably.
Yeah, I think But the ebook is on sale right now. So.
Now are you sold heavily in like airports and?
Yeah, Hudson News has been very nice to me. So yeah, I sell pretty well in the airport.
See, if I were there, I'd be tempted to put it right out front and tell everybody to buy it.
Yeah, I don't have any airline disasters in my book.
You know, I did that.
They should be in the airports, you know. So.
One time I went with Lisa Scottolini. She was selling books at the King of Prussia Mall.
Oh, wow.
And we stood out of that store, and everybody that walked by, I was telling them what books to buy. Here, read this one. It's great.
Oh,
it was so much fun.
You got to come with me the next site. Once in a while, Hudson News will set up a signing at Barbara's Books in O'Hare for me. And
really?
And those are always fun. And, in fact, the last time, it was not the last time, it was 2 years ago, maybe three now, I had a signing there, and they were going downstairs to get the table for me, you know, to be signing at. And I'm waiting around, and I look over, and in the bookstore is Joan Rivers.
What?
and I walked up to her, and I just said, I'm really sorry to bother you, but I just wanted to, I'm going to have to tell my editor that Joan Rivers came to my book signing. She couldn't have been nicer. She was like, "You've got a book out? Where is it? Where? Let me get it. How long have you been writing?" And she
was fun.
Lovely lady. And
did she buy the book?
She bought the book. She had her assistant take a picture of us holding the book. For some reason, I never got the pictures. I'm like a killing. She passed away.
Melissa probably still has them.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Yeah, I bet Melissa's holding on to one somewhere.
She's going to find him in a closet somewhere.
Yeah, she'll find him someplace. But yeah, unfortunately, Joan passed away just about 5 months later. And but she, not to sound creepy, but she was beautiful in person. I don't know what was, you know, she had sort of the Botox look when she was on camera.
Well, she was what, in her 70s then?
She was in her 70s and she was gorgeous. She had a very soft look to her. She was very, and couldn't have been lovelier. She was just a very nice
and
person.
Did she sign the book?
I signed the book for her.
Oh, you signed it for her. Okay.
And you think there was an earthquake because I was shaking so much. Like, to Joan Rivers, it was like, who wrote this? Somebody, you know.
Well, were there people around her trying to talk to her?
People started to catch on. I caught on because somebody did see her and want a picture with her. And so then they left her alone and she was shopping in the store, and I thought, okay, she's alone, no one's talking to her, go over and say hello. Go ahead, just get the gumption up and go say hello
and
to her.
And that didn't seem to bother her.
She couldn't have been more engaging. She was so nice.
Imagine sitting on a plane next to her.
Yeah, well, she wanted to know how long I'd been writing, how many books I'd written. She at least expressed a genuine interest. It was like...
That's amazing.
I think somebody of her caliber, she could have just said, you know, excuse me, I'm shopping right now, and I really need to be left alone. And I probably, my feelings would have been hurt, but no, she...
Well, she must get recognized, must have gotten recognized a lot before she died.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, as soon as we wrapped up, people started coming
over. And this was in Chicago's airport, you said?
Yep, at Barbara's Books in
And you were doing your signing. That's amazing.
I was doing a signing, and so, yep, she was my first sale. It was to Joan Rivers.
That is correct. What did they say when you told them you're the Hudson News people?
They were like, they came, the manager came back and she was like, what's going on? And that Joan had already left.
So you didn't even have the picture you could show her.
No, clerk, I even asked the clerk behind the counter, I said, do you have a phone? Could you take this picture? Because I want to make sure at least someone I know that I could, assistant said, I'll email this to you, or not email, I'll put it on Twitter to you. And I don't have it.
Have you ever met Lisa Scottolini?
No, I haven't.
If you ever get a chance, do make sure you meet her, because she's incredibly wonderful.
Wow. Okay. Isn't it nice when you meet?
You will never meet a nicer.
Pat Conroy was that way to me.
Pat Conroy. You knew Pat Conroy?
Well, I didn't know him, but
you met him
when my first book Seattle, and it was Halloween night. No one was there. So
even for Pat Conroy?
For Pat Conroy, and this was the Prince of Tides, and it was just dead. It was because it was Halloween night, I guess. And the bookstore owner said, "Well, Kevin, yeah, Kevin just got published, Pat, and here's his book, Actors, and blah blah blah." So Pat Conroy talked to me for 20 minutes about the ups and downs of getting published, and he said, "Are you counting copies of how many copies of your book you have, that are in the store?" And I was like, "Of course, all the time." And he said, "When I wrote my first book," he said, "I would call my local bookstore every day, and I'd try and put on a different voice." And he said, "They always knew it was me. It'd be like, Pat, we didn't sell any copies today. Blah 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 blah." And at the end of the evening, I got him to sign The Prince of Tides, and then he plucked my book off the shelf and put his money down and said, "I want you to sign your book for me." And I was just like, "Oh boy, this guy." So he was like my hero for the longest time.
So do you still have that book?
Of course I do. Of course I do. Yeah. Oh, I'm never giving up my copy of Prince of Tides. So because it says here's to actors and your life with books and words, Pat Conroy. And I think
something special.
He was a special, nice guy. I remember my first convention, he was speaking there, and that's all I heard. There was a lot of famous people at this convention, but everybody was saying, "Oh, Pat Conroy's talk is the best." He was, just a very entertaining, nice, accessible guy.
What a boy could he write. That beach music is just something really special.
Yeah, he was great. In fact, I said, there's a few phrases that you kept using in The Prince of Tides The Great Santini that I ended up using in my first book.
And how do you stop from using the same phrases over and over? Does that ever happen to you?
I have to catch myself. I do. I end up using the same stuff, and I'm like, "Oh no, you used this in the last book." So if if somebody has a catchphrase or says something, it's like I got to try and keep track of all 19 books.
Do you ever get tired of writing books that about killers and writing thrillers in general?
If I was going to write any one type of book, this would be the one. So I'm fine writing them, and I think they're light enough in parts that I'm not always oppressed, not always in that sort of dark place. And my villains aren't usually the focus. They are in the books, but they're not usually the focus. So it's psychologically, it's not that taxing for me.
Yeah, I think you read some books and the villains are so evil. You just
they're the focus. They are main character, and it's hard to stick with it.
If you want to read some of the sickest villains you've ever read in a book, read Chris Carter.
I've heard lots of stuff about him. Yeah.
Wow. Now he writes a whole series, and every one of his books is one of the most fascinating things you'll ever read.
Yeah, I've heard none. I haven't read any of stuff that I've heard great things.
They are the goriest scenes in books you'll ever read.
I try and avoid that. I just find it too excessive. I know that was the only time my
editor like watching
really...
Saw in a book.
Yeah. And I think my editor wants me to be a tiny bit gorier than I am.
Will that sell more books, do you think?
I don't know. I think it does work. It works.
I think your editor thinks it will.
I think he does. Or he just
more blood, more
it.
Blood.
More terror or something like that. Yeah.
And speaking of blood, I got a letter one time from Dean Koontz who had written to.
Oh wow!
And he sent me a handwritten letter back, and it had little drops of blood at the bottom of it. But they weren't. It wasn't real blood.
Oh, it was on the stationery.
He had colored
reprinted.
It red.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But it was on the stationery. These little drops of blood.
Oh, that's worth framing. That's definitely worth keeping.
Like, it's not often you get a letter from Dean Koontz with blood on it.
No. There's something extra personal too.
That's right.
Like I got his blood on my.
I had to make sure it wasn't real blood. I was like, is this real blood or just like? I forget what they use.
A forensics expert. Yeah.
What is it they use in the movies? I forget. They use some kind of mix or something.
They use. I know. Well, I know it was chocolate syrup for Janet Leigh in Psycho. So.
Chocolate syrup.
That's what they say. It was chocolate syrup.
Just in case she gets hungry afterwards, you know?
Yeah, she can lap it off the bottom of the tub.
Yeah, that's so... I don't know why we're laughing. It was such a serious scene. But we're laughing at her.
Well, she made jokes, but she was pretty...
What you know. Did you see what they did in the Bates Motel?
No.
You haven't watched Bates Motel?
I watched the first two seasons.
The take they do on the shower scene is going to shock you.
Oh, really?
You know, okay. I'm not going to tell you what happens because you haven't watched it yet, but it's going to surprise you. It's going to surprise you.
There's one of those things, for some reason I lost interest after a couple of...
No, Bates Motel is wonderful.
Okay.
Wonderful.
I must have... I'll give it another shot.
Vera Farmiga, she just has so much fun with it.
I thought the acting was great and everything else.
She's incredible.
I can kick myself. I know I started watching The Sopranos, and I stopped watching that because I got... Like, I'm not that interested, and I wish I'd stuck with it. But,
no, Bates Motel's wonderful, and the scenes with her and Freddie Highmore are just incredible to watch.
Oh, I'll have to go back.
The way they fight is just phenomenal to watch.
Well, I've heard from several people that it's really good, so... I'll go back.
What they do to that shower scene, oh my God.
Oh,
I mean, wait till you see what they do.
All right. You got me curious now.
Because I thought, I'm not going to say anything because I'll ruin it for you. It would be a shame to ruin it if you haven't seen it.
No, you know what I'll do? I think I'll make that my, what I do when I'm really under the gun to try and finish a book, I'll get involved with a series so that I, as a reward, I'll watch one or maybe two episodes as a reward. Like, okay, you got this much done. Take a break. Watch part of, you know. So I went through Seinfeld. I've been through... God, which one? I think I was watching Friends when I finished Hide Your Fear. I think that was... It was Friends.
So you're working on another book now, and you'll be done in November, you said?
Yes. November 1st it's due. No excuses, so it's and I was just reviewing the first chapter because they want that by the end of the week for a special sort of insert for something, for the press thing. So
will it be bloodier than the Hide Your Fear?
Let's see, I'm trying to think. No, it's more suspense. At the beginning, there's not a lot of blood, but there's a lot of carnage. There's a lot of people get killed.
What's great about your books is everyone is different. I mean, none of them remind you of any others. I mean,
thank you.
And that's a big accomplishment. Yeah, it's a big accomplishment because there are authors, and I'm not naming any names, who some of their books remind you of others of their books. So you, and it's very easy to get stuck in that. To write the same kind of thing over and over again.
Well, especially when you do one after another. In fact, I started to tell you when I got together with Paula Hawkins for an interview.
Yeah, lucky you.
I know, to promote her new book.
Now, does she have a British accent?
She does. She has one of those really great British accents. And I interviewed her at Seattle Town Hall. It was one of those author-to-author things. And she'd asked me, she said, well, you know, with your books, how often do you have between books? And I said, about a year. Each book comes out every year. And she's like, and they're standalones? She said, you do standalones one a year? And I said, yeah, and they're about 500 pages. And she just shook her head and said, it took me 3 years to, you know, finish this book after Girl on the Train. So I got a little bit of a nod of admiration for
how do you do it?
from a heavy hitter.
She's hoping it's going to rub off on her.
Wouldn't it be nice to be able to get that much of a fan base each time you wrote a book? I think Into the Water is still number one, if I'm not mistaken. It might have slipped down to number two.
Well, I think John Grisham's book might be number one.
Oh, that's right. Camino Island probably took over.
He tends to go right to the top.
Yep.
But he's doing bookstore things.
I know.
What it must be, the world is weird when John Grisham is doing bookstore appearances. Because he doesn't do a lot.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and I'm realizing this as more each time I do another book. Is usually I'll have a book come out in the summer, and that's when I'm trying to get the next book written.
See, that's when you should have your bookstore appearances on October 31st.
Yeah. Of course, then I'll look like hell, though, from lack of sleep, and I'll be all afraid that
the kids can't read them. The kids are not allowed to read them.
So. Yeah, I'll be catatonic. Yeah, well, this was Kevin O'Brien, but he's so fried out from finishing his book that I'm convinced. It's so funny every time I'm trying to finish a book, I always think I'm dying of something. Okay. Something's wrong. I think I'm getting this. This arm hurts. I think I'm having a stroke. Oh, this this foot hurts. I think this.
Well, it's probably your arm. Probably hurts because you've been writing so much.
I've been writing. Yeah.
Well, that's what happens. You get carpal tunnel syndrome. Do you have to have insurance for that?
No, I do have a ice pad that I use. I've got a little one of those gel packs that I keep in the freezer, and I'll take it out and I'll.
So what was the first printing on your books? Did they ever tell you?
It changes between each printing. Sometimes it's been like 70,000, and sometimes it's like 100. I've had it be 120. I've had it be 70.
Well, you've been on the New York Times any number of times, right?
Times, yeah. So which was very nice. So I get to call myself a New York Times best-selling author. So that's that's part of my name now. You have to say no. Don't call me Kevin. Call me New York Times best-selling author Kevin.
Now, do your books get into libraries?
Oh yes, and in fact, we're really gonna. I told the publicity people at Kensington. I said, make sure that you let the libraries know because the heroine of my book is a librarian. So.
Oh right, yes.
Yeah, so,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was no mistake. In fact, I did. I had a library gig when I was writing the book, and I asked for a lot of feedback from people about. What it's like to be in a small town library and everything else. And some of what I have in that book is directly quoted from them. One of the people said, I could tell by the smell of some books when they returned who had checked it out because we'd know the people so well. They were very helpful. So.
Well, your book again, it's been so great to talk to you. I could talk all night to you.
Oh.
He's had so much
great
fun.
Talking to you.
And the book goes on sale, just remind everybody, 7/25.
You got it. Starting then, they can pre-order it or go to your bookstore and pre-order it.
Cool.
For sure.
And you can use it as a doorstop, too.
You
it's
can
very
use
vegan.
It as a doorstop if you want. But just in time.
After you read it, though. You must read it first.
And you can get yourself all started up with some of my older books if you haven't read this one.
I don't think you could get this book and not read it. It's just so interesting. If you had it and used it as a doorstop, you'd still have to read it.
Well, somebody gets killed in chapter one. I always try and knock somebody off in chapter one, and so.
I'm glad you never get mad at me. It would probably be me that's dead.
Oh yeah, don't cross me. Somebody gave me a T-shirt that says "Careful, you'll end up."
That's why Elizabeth George is so nice to you.
Yeah. I got to be nice to Elizabeth George too.
And I need to know when her next book's coming out because that woman's
I will
phenomenal
try and
genius.
Find out. Like I say, I might see her. I know we have some. We're in the same organization, the Seattle Seven Authors, Seattle Seven Writers.
You make sure after you ask her, let me know.
Okay.
What she says, because I'm dying to know. It's probably going to be next year, I would think.
Yeah, and hers are not small books either. So. Yeah.
And if you don't see her, that's a good thing. It means she's working.
It means that she's she's hard at work.
Thinking of the next plot. So the book again is called Hide Your Fear. It's out from Kensington and all your bookstores and ebooks and everything. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.